How egregiously can a majority party gerrymander a political map before it violates the Constitution? The Supreme Court has tried to answer that question for 30 years, and on Tuesday, October 2, 2017, it will try again, hearing arguments in a case involving the Wisconsin State Assembly that could remake an American political landscape split apart by polarization and increasingly fenced off for partisan advantage. We asked three experts to explain partisan gerrymandering in the U.S. Constitution. The speakers are Rob Yablon, law professor at UW-Madison Law School, Barry Burden, professor of political science at UW-Madison, and David Cannon, also professor of political science at UW-Madison. The talk took place on September 28, 2017, on the UW-Madison campus and was sponsored by the Madison Institute, the League of Women Voters of Dane County and Wisconsin, Common Cause Wisconsin, the American Constitution Society, and Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. First, we hear from Fred Wade, chair of the Madison Institute, who will introduce each speaker.
Professor Robert Yablon is an assistant professor of law at the University of Wisconsin Law School. Received his undergraduate degree from Madison. Received his law degree at Yale. Clerked for Justices Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Sonia Sotomayor before working in private practice for a while and then coming to the law school. He will kick off the discussion tonight with a presentation focusing on how we got to where we are with the Whitford case and kind of set that up as to how we got there.
So as Fred said, I'm going to be kicking off with some general background discussion, and I'll save most of the discussion of the specific case that's now being litigated, Gill versus Whitford, for Barry and David. And in particular, what I'm going to cover first is just to give you a definition of gerrymandering, offer a glimpse into the history of the practice. I'll then briefly describe some of the largely self-evident reasons why we might object to gerrymandering. And then I'll discuss some past efforts to redress gerrymandering through the courts. And hopefully that will provide you with a sense of where we stand now, both legally and practically, as the Gill versus Whitford litigation unfolds. So gerrymandering at its most basic is the practice of dividing a geographical area into political units in a manner that gives some groups a special advantage over others. Now, the lines that are drawn may be manipulated to benefit a variety of groups. You may gerrymander in an effort to give a political edge to rural voters over urban ones, to advantage some racial or ethnic groups over others, to advantage incumbents over challengers, or possibly because you want to advantage one political party over another. And that's what's known as partisan gerrymandering. And when we refer to gerrymandering generically tonight, I think all of us are referring specifically to partisan gerrymandering. Those other forms of gerrymandering raise their own issues, have their own bits of legal doctrine that apply to them, and we're mostly going to be leaving that off to one side tonight. So when it comes to partisan gerrymandering, the definition of the concept sort of indicates two preconditions that you might think about for when gerrymandering is a risk. And one is you need to have a system that relies on electoral districting to elect representatives. There's no gerrymandering in gubernatorial races or U.S. Senate races or state Supreme Court races because those elections are statewide, and so there's no opportunity to manipulate the lines. But at the federal level, we elect members of the U.S. House of Representatives through districts. We have 8 of them in Wisconsin. Around the country, state legislators are elected in districts. And many localities also rely on districts to elect local representatives. So that necessitates a lot of line drawing. And in the modern United States, lines end up getting redrawn every 10 years following the decennial census. The most recent census occurred in 2010, and the most recent line drawing occurred after that. And we redraw the lines at that point mainly to ensure that districts remain roughly equal in population, even as populations shift from place to place. And in some instances, at least at the federal level, you may have states increase or decrease the number of members of Congress they have, and that necessitates the redrawing of lines. But of course, every time you open the door to line redrawing, you also open the door to other gamesmanship that can arise, including the possibility of partisan gerrymandering. So the first precondition is you need to have districting, a districting system. The second is you need to have the process of redistricting in the hands of partisans. And in about 39 states, it is in fact the case that partisans have primary responsibility for redistricting. And more than that, you're most likely to get partisan redistricting when it is one party that controls all of the levers of state government. If you have divided government in the state, either the houses of the legislature are controlled by different parties, or one party controls the legislature but the other controls the governor, you're unlikely to have the conditions for an aggressive partisan gerrymander because the parties can check each other. Either they'll reach a compromise or they'll be unable to reach a compromise, and the lines may be redrawn by a court, again, in an effort to assure that population remains roughly equal after a census. So how do you gerrymander? Well, at a high level of abstraction, the method is very straightforward. It's called packing and cracking. Now, what packing is you basically take all of the voters for the other party and you try to stick them into as few districts as possible. So you try to create a district that is 90% Democratic, and they'll be able to elect a Democrat, but they are now overly packed into that district, and that leaves fewer Democrats in other districts. And so in other districts, the Democrats are cracked, and they are insufficient in number to be able to elect representatives of their choice. Now, at the implementation stage, it gets more complicated because you need data about who your voters are and where they live. You know, who are the reliable Democrats? Who are the reliable Republicans? In what communities, on what blocks do they reside? And then as you actually go through the process of drawing lines, you have to be attentive to a number of legal obligations and other concerns. The obligation to maintain roughly equal population, requirements of the Voting Rights Act that pertain to race, respecting political subdivisions is often a requirement in many states. So it can be difficult, but this is something that is not, by any stretch of the imagination, a new innovation in American politics. The most famous gerrymander in American political history might date to 1812 in Massachusetts. You had the Democratic-Republican Party, which controlled the state Senate in Massachusetts. They were worried about losing power to the Federalist Party, and so they decided to try to manipulate the lines of the state Senate in order to retain power. And the governor of Massachusetts at the time, a guy named Elbridge Gerry, signed off on it. Well, the districts ended up, unsurprisingly, having somewhat odd shapes, and creative newspaper editors at the time decided that one of them looked like a salamander. And so they dubbed this the Gerrymander, or as it's now come down to us, the gerrymander. And this was a remarkably successful gerrymander. In the next election, the Federalists and the Democratic-Republican Party each took about 50% of the vote, but the Democratic-Republicans managed to retain 29 of the 40 seats in the Massachusetts State Senate, leaving only 11 for the Federalists. So since then, we have had gerrymanders of all forms. We've moved on from salamanders to squirrels, snakes, ostriches, elephant heads, amoeba, butterflies splattered on windshields. But this has been a recurrent phenomenon in election after election, and both sides, both parties are guilty of it. So why do we find gerrymandering to be problematic? Well, it is, in a very basic sense, an affront to notions of fairness. Commentators like to say that in a democracy, voters should elect their representatives and not the other way around. But we can also identify some more concrete democratic harms that flow from gerrymandering. One is that it can contribute to political polarization. If you draw districts that are safely Republican or safely Democrat, then there's no need to appeal to the center of the electorate in that district. You end up with representatives being elected who are quite Republican and quite Democrat, quite liberal or conservative, and they may have little desire or incentive to work with people on the other side. You also, with gerrymandering, can get entrenchment because you don't have very many toss-up districts. And incumbents, although they might face some heat within their own parties, they're unlikely to face serious general election challenges, and that renders them less accountable to the electorate, to their constituencies.
You're listening to Partisan Gerrymandering in the U.S. Constitution. The speakers are Rob Yablon, law professor at UW-Madison Law School, Barry Burden, professor of political science at UW-Madison, and David Cannon, professor of political science at UW-Madison.
Related to polarization and entrenchment with gerrymandering, you can get a rise in phenomena like cynicism, disaffection, and disengagement among the electorate. You know, why even bother to vote if the result has already been preordained by the way that the lines have been drawn? Now, commentators may debate how serious some of these harms are in practice, but there are a few people actually who go out and defend gerrymandering as an affirmative democratic good. And so you may wonder if there's consensus that this is not a great practice, why has it persisted for more than two centuries? Well, if you wanted to redress gerrymandering, you have a couple of options. One is you can turn to the political process. Now, that is unlikely to be successful most of the time, because you're going to be asking people who are trying to entrench themselves in power to give up one of the most powerful tools of doing so. Now, in a few places, people have managed to work around their state legislators. They've gone through initiatives and referenda to adopt independent commissions, things like that, which you may hear more about later. But for the most part, we sort of are stuck through the political process with the gerrymandering situation that we have. So it might then seem that it would be natural to turn to the courts. Right? The courts have intervened in the political process in myriad other ways over the past decades. When it comes to partisan gerrymandering, though, they have been extremely reluctant to get involved. Now, when a partisan gerrymandering case reaches a court, basically there are two preliminary questions that the court needs to get straight. One is, the court needs to decide, is partisan gerrymandering justiciable in the first place? Or is it a so-called political question, the kind of issue that needs to be left exclusively to the political process to work out, whatever the difficulties they may have in practice actually working it out? You know, is it the kind of issue that the Constitution has left to other branches besides the courts? The second issue is, if a court were to address partisan gerrymandering, what are the doctrinal principles and standards that they should apply? Right? In other words, on what basis should they be distinguishing normal redistricting that's legally permissible and legitimate from unlawful and unconstitutional gerrymandering? Now, the more courts struggle with that second question, the more likely they are just to say that it's non-justiciable in the first place, because part of determining whether something is justiciable is determining whether there is, in fact, a manageable standard for addressing it. And neither of these questions are easy questions to answer. They're both tricky. I mean, for one thing, there is no precise constitutional provision on point when it comes to gerrymandering. And so litigants and courts need to turn to more amorphous constitutional provisions, such as the Equal Protection Clause, and provisions like that provide more limited guidance. Second, practically speaking, some partisanship may just be inevitable or inherent, and maybe even desirable in districting. So, for example, there might be instances in which you district with an awareness of the partisan consequences of what you're doing, but you're nevertheless drawing districts that are very reasonable-looking districts that are keeping political subdivisions together and things like that. And so you may understand that you are advantaging your party, but at the same time, you're kind of doing things in a fairly standard way. Well, is that a constitutional violation? I mean, how far should a right against partisan gerrymandering extend? So those are tough questions to resolve, where the lines should exist. The Supreme Court has confronted these issues on two occasions in the past. The first was in the mid-1980s in a case called Davis versus Bandemer. And that involved redistricting of the Indiana state legislature. Republicans controlled the process. Democrats thought they got a raw deal and were being underrepresented in the state legislature in violation, they said, of the equal protection guarantee of the 14th Amendment. The Supreme Court in that case divided. A majority of the court said, you know what, this is a justiciable political question. You are permitted to come to court and argue that this districting scheme violates the Equal Protection Clause. But a majority of the court in that case also held that there was no equal protection violation in that case, that the gerrymander in that case was not so bad as to violate the Constitution. And in reaching that conclusion, the court said, in order to establish that you have an unlawful partisan gerrymander, you need to show a discriminatory intent and a discriminatory effect. And the court said, let's just assume, yes, there is a discriminatory intent here. How do you go about showing that there is an actual discriminatory effect? The court said it's not enough as the Democrats in Indiana claimed, that they were underrepresented, that they were not able to elect representatives in proportion to the votes that they were getting statewide. The court said it has to be more than that, and they set kind of a high bar, a high bar, but also an ambiguous one. They said that an unconstitutional arrangement is one that consistently degrades a voter's or group of voters' influence on the political process as a whole, and that requires, quote, evidence of continued frustration of the will of the majority of the voters or the effective denial to a majority of voters of a fair chance to influence the political process. And the court said, even if you Democrats are not able to elect as many representatives as you like, that doesn't necessarily mean that you have really been locked out of the political process as a whole. You haven't satisfied that high bar. So in the wake of Davis versus Bandemer, the Supreme Court had given an invitation to litigate, but it turned out in practice that it was really an invitation to litigate in vain. So you had case after case brought in the lower courts, and nearly everyone was rejected. Well, 18 years later, the Supreme Court returns to the issue of partisan gerrymandering in a case called Veith versus Jubilier, which was decided in 2004. This time, the court is dealing with congressional districts from the state of Pennsylvania. Again, you had Republicans drawing the lines, and they managed to create a 12 of 19 congressional districts in basically a 50-50 state that were safely Republican, and the Democrats again challenged it. And once again, the Supreme Court fractures, even more than they did in Bandemer. You get 4 of the 9 justices saying this time that the issue is non-justiciable in its entirety. In other words, you don't even have a right to come to court and try to make the argument. Writing for those justices, Justice Scalia described Bandemer as having produced, quote, puzzlement and consternation in the lower courts. In his view, it was a failed experiment and it was time to end it. He just saw no judicially discernible or manageable standard, at least not one that had a principled constitutional hook. On the other side, there were 4 justices, Stevens, Souter, Ginsburg, and Breyer, who said that it was justiciable. But they declined to endorse the Bandemer test, recognizing the weakness of that test for discriminatory effect. Instead, what those 4 justices did is they produced 3 separate opinions offering 3 distinct standards. Now, on one hand, maybe that plays right into Justice Scalia's hand to show that we don't actually have a standard for managing this. On the other hand, maybe it shows that there's more than one way to skin the gerrymandering cat. Well, so you have 4 saying justiciable, 4 not. That leaves 1 justice in the middle. You might guess who that justice was. It was Justice Anthony Kennedy. And what he says in Veith is he expresses concern about the practice of partisan gerrymandering. But he also says that he doesn't like any of the standards that have been proposed thus far. He also worries about the judiciary becoming too deeply enmeshed in oversight of the districting process, expressing concern about, quote, unprecedented intervention in the American political process. And so his opinion ultimately says, quote, I would not foreclose all possibility of judicial relief if some limited and precise rationale were found to correct an established violation of the Constitution in some redistricting cases. So when I teach this to my students, I call this the never say never opinion. So Justice Kennedy is not willing to say categorically this is non-justiciable, but he's also not willing to say for sure that it is. He wants to wait and see if there is some standard that emerges that he likes. The bottom line is that the law after Veith is even more uncertain than it was before. And in the 13 years since then, lawyers and scholars have been trying to come up with potential standards that will be pleasing to Justice Kennedy. And this involves both articulating the legal principles, the overarching legal principles, in ways that he might find attractive, and also maybe trying to develop some new social science metrics that seek to quantify the severity and the likely durability of a gerrymander to provide some assurance that not every single districting is going to be an occasion for unending litigation and that the court really is going to be able to manage the process in an effective way. Now, in the meantime, gerrymandering has considered basically unabated. It's arguably worse than ever, in part because of polarization that may in part be attributable to previous gerrymanders. There's an increased incentive to do it, and technology has increased the capability of those who want to gerrymander. There's better data available than there's ever been, and more computing power as well. Now, after the 2010 census, the redistricting that occurred, there also was a lot of single-party control at that point. 2010 was a wave election for the Republicans. So although both sides have been guilty of gerrymandering, the Republicans since 2010 have had more opportunity to do it. And they have, in fact, been very deliberate and systematic about doing so, including here in Wisconsin. And so I will leave it there and turn it over to Barry to talk more specifically about what has been going on in this state.
Professor Barry Burden is professor of political science at the University of Madison, director of the Elections Research Center, and Lyons Family Chair in Electoral Politics. He will talk to us primarily about the Whitford case itself.
So I want to tell you a bit about what happened in Wisconsin with the Whitford case, now known as the Gill case, and how political scientists have come to be part of the case to augment the work that attorneys have done thus far. So I'll take you back to the 2010 census, which was the last national census. Those data were delivered to the states, and states were given the opportunity to draw new districts. As Rob mentioned, Republicans were in control of that process in Wisconsin. It was the first time since the 1950s that Republicans had unified control of the governorship, both chambers of the state legislature, during a redistricting round. They were effective in their redistricting, by my assessment. In the next set of elections, the assembly elections that happened in 2012, if you add up all the votes cast for Democratic candidates, all the votes cast for Republican candidates, Democrats won that election 53% to 46%. In fact, they also won at the top of the ticket. You might remember Barack Obama won the state fairly handily. Tammy Baldwin won a Senate race that year. But despite that Democratic wave, Democrats only won 39 of the 99 assembly seats, or 39% of the vote. So there was a gap between the 53% of the vote they had won and the 39% of the seats they garnered. That was repeated in a less extreme way in 2014 and 2016. And so Republicans have hung on. So on the back of those results, the Whitford case gets filed in federal court here in Madison. A decision comes down about 10 days after the election, while all of us were still focused on the Electoral College win of Donald Trump and other things that surprised us in the election. Here comes an opinion from a three-judge panel out of Madison, with two of the judges striking down the assembly maps in Wisconsin on the basis of two constitutional issues. One, the First Amendment right of freedom of association, which is a recognized part of freedom of speech, and the other on the 14th Amendment, the equal protection under the laws. These are essentially the rights of Democrats that were violated by Republicans who drew the maps. That was the argument and the decision. Now, the court, I suppose, could have decided to redraw the maps themselves, and in previous rounds in Wisconsin, courts have often done that. But instead, they ordered the state, meaning the state legislature and the governor, to go ahead and redraw the maps and bring them into compliance with the court's decision by November 1. That is now on hold as the US Supreme Court hears the case on Tuesday. So on what basis were the judges in Madison willing to strike down the maps? This is where the political scientists enter the picture. In particular, there's a metric being offered in this case by political scientists thinking about Justice Kennedy and the request he made in the Veith case for a standard that would let him identify when a map was merely partisan shenanigans that ought to be tolerable within limits, and when those partisan shenanigans had become extreme enough that they were violating some voters' constitutional rights. The measure being offered in this case is known as the efficiency gap, developed by Eric McGee and Nick Stephanopoulos, who's also one of the litigators in the case. This is a measure of the relative number of votes that are wasted for Democratic and Republican voters. What do we mean by wasted votes? These are essentially votes that result from packing or cracking, such that there are either more votes than are needed to elect a person of a particular party, or votes that are cast for a losing candidate and so don't contribute to the victory of a candidate. There will always be wasted votes in any system that has districts where one person is elected to hold the seat. But what the efficiency gap gets us is the relative number of votes that are wasted for each party. It may be that a map packs everyone. All districts are either 100% Democratic or 100% Republican, and that might be acceptable as long as the wastage is equal on both sides. But the efficiency gap indicates for us in a very simple percentage on which side of the spectrum that waste tends to fall. And so it actually builds on an older idea in political science of symmetry as a standard in maps. A legislative map might really harm the party that doesn't do well in terms of earning votes, but it ought to harm the other party just as much if the situation were flipped. So the efficiency gap tells us that. What it produces is a percentage, which may be either positive or negative, a negative number meaning it advantages Republicans, a positive number meaning it advantages Democrats, and it's a percentage of the number of seats that a party got in excess of what it should have gotten given its vote share. Right? It's a measure of the bonus that it earned as a result of the districting at play. It does not call for proportional representation. It doesn't demand competitive districts or any of the other things that sometimes get confused in the issues here. So in 2012 and 2014, the plaintiffs computed the efficiency gap for the Wisconsin Assembly maps, and the numbers were -13% and -10% for those two elections, meaning that Republicans got 13% more in seats and then 10% more in seats than you would have expected based on the votes alone. Presumably, if the Supreme Court decides to affirm the federal court decision, that would strike down not only the Wisconsin maps, but also about 15 other states' legislative maps that are in that same territory. Now, the other place that political scientists get involved in the case is as experts and briefers for the court. So I want to mention what political scientists had to say in the original federal court decision. There were two experts who worked on behalf of the plaintiffs and two who worked on behalf of the defense. One of the plaintiff experts was my colleague Ken Mayer, who produced for the case a demonstration map showing that it was possible to draw the 99 assembly districts, keeping intact county borders and communities of interest in a better way than the actual map had, and with a smaller efficiency gap, compared to the negative 13% that actually emerged in the 2012 election. Mayer's map produced an efficiency gap of only negative 2%. Still an advantage for the Republicans. Some of that is baked into the way Republicans and Democrats are scattered across the state and across the country, with Democratic voters tending to be more concentrated in urban areas and Republicans distributed more efficiently. But he hoped that his map would show that it was possible to produce districts that were nicer looking, they were more compact, held together communities, and produced a smaller benefit for one party. The other expert for the plaintiffs was Simon Jackman from Stanford University. He collected all of the data on every legislative election in every state from 1972 until 2014 and computed the efficiency gap for every one of those maps. The purpose in doing that is to see whether the values in Wisconsin of negative 13% and negative 10% were in line with what we normally see, or they were extreme relative to that distribution of all the other maps we had seen. He concluded that that sequence of two elections in Wisconsin was probably the most extreme sequence of two elections he had seen in that entire 40-plus year time series. And he suggested as a result of his analysis that a reasonable standard for the court to adopt might be a threshold of plus or minus 7% on the efficiency gap. That's the point at which you go from essentially noise in the map-making process to something that's discernible statistically. So again, if that were the case, the Wisconsin maps would be struck down. There were also two experts on the other side working for the defense. One was Nick Gettert from Lafayette College. The other was Sean Trendy, who you may have heard of. He's a blogger and author and now a political science student. They had numerous complaints about what the plaintiffs had done in the case. The number one complaint was that the efficiency gap was not a valid measure of wasted votes, was not a reliable measure of wasted votes. In fact, the number does change from one election to the next, so it's not really a measure of the map. It's a measure of the election results and how they compare to some standard. They also complained that this was not a judiciable issue because it dealt merely with partisanship. And in fact, because the maps favored Republicans, that's really just a sign of the geographic sorting of people, Democrats into urban areas and Republicans elsewhere. And there had been a trend in favor of the Republicans even before the 2010 census and the 2010 maps were in place. And so what we saw in 2012 and 2014 was just a continuation of long-term trends in society. Now, if you look at the documents related to the case online, you'll see that there are many amicus briefs that have been submitted to the court, providing what they think is helpful information. A record number of these, I think, have come from political scientists. They do a variety of things, most of them in favor of the plaintiffs. Many of them suggest alternative measures to the efficiency gap that the justices might use, in particular Justice Kennedy might use as a standard. Some of these measures involve simulating neutral districts using a computer and then comparing the actual districts to that distribution to see whether the maps that exist look like the maps you would get from a neutral process or look extreme relative to that distribution. Another method is to compare the vote in the mean district in the state to the vote in the median district in the state. And the gap between those things indicates an unfair advantage for one party or the other. Fortunately, most of these measures tell the same story as the efficiency gap, and that's part of the reason for the amicus briefs. Before I wrap, I want to mention one amicus brief that's close to my heart because I signed it. I was one of 17 political scientists who submitted a brief a couple of weeks ago arguing that the court ought to find in favor of the plaintiffs and strike down the maps, but with a somewhat different reasoning. The reasoning is that the standards that had been used in the past are not going to be as useful in map making today. In particular, standards like the one that Sandra Day O'Connor favored, looking at the visual compactness of the districts as a sign for some shenanigans that had gone on, might have worked in the 1970s and 80s and maybe 1990s. But today, map makers have reached a level of sophistication and technical expertise, relying on consultants and software and other things that are now available to them, that makes it possible to draw maps that have extreme partisan advantage, but without tipping off people looking at maps by producing non-compact or irregularly shaped districts. So that ought to no longer be our standard. And moreover, it's no longer necessary to pack your own supporters into a district in an extreme way to essentially guarantee that your party wins a seat. Because partisanship has become so ingrained and such a strong predictor of how voters vote, it's possible with only 55% or 60% of your supporters in a district to essentially lock in an advantage in a district for the next decade until the next redistricting cycle in which that same party will be responsible for drawing the maps. So with that, let me stop and hand over to David to talk about some of the implications.
And then we have David Cannon. He is a professor also at the University of Wisconsin Political Science Department, and he teaches courses on American government with a focus on Congress, race, and politics, the president, and political parties.
I have a lot of pretty pictures to show to go along with many of the points that Rob and Barry made about both the nature of redistricting and packing and cracking, but also with the expert testimony in the federal district court case regarding the Whitford case. I can show you some of the analysis that was done concerning the efficiency gap and some of the follow-ups that also were presented in some of the amicus briefs in the Supreme Court case. And then I'll conclude showing the arguments for the case as being presented on Tuesday, and then wrap up just a little bit on potential reforms. So I wasn't sure exactly the order that they were going to go with their comments, so I'm not going to show all these, but this was, I gave a talk yesterday at the Rotary Club, and so a lot of these are from that. But I wanted to start with an example of cracking, and then I'll show you packing as well. So this comes from the state of Maryland, and comparing what they did in the previous round of redistricting to what they did in the current round of redistricting, the blue district across the northern part of the state and then the eastern district on the eastern seaboard there were the only two Republican districts in the state of Maryland. The rest of them are controlled by Democrats. And then, so the Democrats got a little greedy in the next decade, and they said, let's take one of those Republican districts away. And so you can see that the blue district basically got chopped up into three different Democratic districts. That's a classic example of cracking. And here, too, I just, for your entertainment, I showed the district that surrounds the Baltimore area. As probably one of the ugliest districts you'll ever see in terms of, and this one was in fact called a bug splattered on a windshield, to try to group enough Democrats to create a nice, safe district there. So that's a classic example of a Democratic gerrymander that was cracking. Now, also, just to back up Rob's point, this is a bipartisan effort here that both parties do this, all the time when they have the opportunity. This is a classic example of packing coming from the state of North Carolina, from the current round of redistricting. Now, these district lines were struck down in a federal court because of a racial gerrymander, another type of gerrymander. But these districts were in effect for 2012 and 2014. And in a state that, again, is pretty competitive, Barack Obama carried it in 2008. He narrowly lost it by about 2 points to Mitt Romney in 2012. Democrats have won statewide elections there over that time. And, you know, it's a leaning Republican state, but very competitive state. Republicans were able to carry 10 of the 13 House districts by packing Democrats into the three blue districts. All three of those are fairly funny-looking districts. They had to really try pretty hard in order to get Democrats packed into those three districts and pick up the other 10. And to prove the point that the lines can be drawn for both parties' advantage, a Democratic plan then is shown in the middle one. This is a hypothetical map. If the Democrats had been in charge, what could have they done? With the same election results, okay? So you don't change anything in terms of how people voted. All you're doing is changing the lines. And you can produce a map for those same two elections that gets you 9 Democrats instead of 10 Republicans out of the 13. These maps, actually, the districts are not quite as funny looking as they are in the map that generated the 10 Republican seats. And then finally, reformers that are advocating for bipartisan commissions, which shows it's possible in North Carolina to create a nice balanced set of maps in a state that's roughly 50-50. They'll give you 5 Democrats, 5 Republicans of relatively safe seats, and then 3 districts that would be competitive year after year. And so that's an argument then for saying that having the state legislature not draw the maps, but instead have a nonpartisan or bipartisan commission draw them, could produce districts that are much more competitive and fair in terms of partisanship. So that gives an example then of the cracking and packing in other states. Well, what about it in Wisconsin? Well, in Wisconsin, we did have a very sort of expertly drawn set of maps that did a really excellent job of maximizing Republican advantage by cracking the Democratic votes, putting them in districts where they wouldn't have quite enough to win, and then efficiently allocating Republican voters into the districts where they would have the maximum opportunity to win. And this comes from Ken Mayer's expert report in the federal district court case that Barry mentioned. So what we're looking at here is on the horizontal axis is the percent of Republican vote in the 2012 assembly races. So in the midpoint is a 50-50 divide. Anything to the left are Democratic-leaning districts where Republicans get less than 50%. Anything to the right, Republicans are getting more than 50%. So you can see with the actual election results from 2012, that there were very few districts that were competitive leaning in the Democratic direction. There were just 3 that were in the 45 to 50 range of Republican vote or 50 to 55 for Democratic vote, and only 3 more that were in the 40 to 45 range of Republican vote or 55 to 60% Democratic vote. The only 6 total in that range of what we normally consider to be competitive districts. On the Republican side of that divide, you have 38 districts. Okay, so 6 compared to 38. And so it really was a very efficient job of allocating Republican voters into those districts that had the best chance of efficiently allocating them. And then the Democratic side, not so much. Now, one thing that you could argue that this is not quite a fair characterization of the underlying nature of the districts themselves is that this is including all the uncontested races. So you can see the packing coming into play by 23 districts on the Democratic side being unopposed and 4 on the Republican. So a better way to look at it might be to look at actual projected votes. And this is from Keith Gaddy's analysis. He was one of the experts that the Republicans used when they drew the maps to try to gauge, what the expected results would be. There are 45 Republican districts that are clumped in that competitive range on their side of the divide, only 21 on the Democratic side of the divide. And so this is, again, sort of a classic example of cracking. Barry mentioned the demonstration map that Ken Mayer drew. Well, here's what Ken's demonstration map looks like using this same way of looking at the votes. There's still a bit of a Republican advantage, but not very much. So they have 29 districts now in that range just to the right of the divide. The Democrats have 27. So it's fairly normally distributed around that midpoint of competitive races. And so, again, you can draw maps in a way that would be competitive and not give one party much of an advantage. And Barry mentioned the overall efficiency gap was 2% for Republicans under this demonstration map. Now, just to get a little more detailed, and this was replicated around the state, but just one example of Sheboygan, how this is actually accomplished. Like, how do you get that bar chart of all these results? Well, here's one example of how it happened. And so you had one, relatively safe Democratic seat that in the town of the city of Sheboygan, that was about 80-some percent of the population of the district was the city. They divide the city in half, crack it into two districts, and then in the current map, Republicans pick up all of the seats by splitting Sheboygan in half. And that was done in other cities around the state in order to gain that efficient allocation of Republican voters compared to Democratic voters. So that's the way that it was accomplished. Now, in terms of the state's defense for their argument that this was not something that should be a constitutional violation, they had two main arguments. One was to say that this has always been a political question and that there are no constitutional protections for Democrats and Republicans the way there are for, say, based on gender or race or ethnicity. And so there's no sort of constitutional violation. They would argue it's not a justiciable question because there's no constitutional protection based on partisanship. And this is not, partisan gerrymandering has never risen to the level of a constitutional violation. They argue that in this case it shouldn't either. And then they back that up by saying that furthermore, the lines, while they did give a Republican advantage, much of this is due to the nature of the way that voters distribute themselves voluntarily by where they live. So Democrats are more concentrated in Milwaukee and Madison. They live in more densely populated areas. Republicans are more spread efficiently across the state. And so the argument is that even if you drew these maps neutrally, then you still would have a Republican advantage. And then finally, they concluded by showing that even with the maps that were drawn, they still did respect the traditional districting principles to about the same level that previous maps had. And they compared it favorably to the map drawn by the federal district court in 2002 and said, look, it really is not that different than the map that the federal judge drew. And they show here that it's actually not that different than the map that Ken Mayer drew in the demonstration plan. And indeed, it has a lower population deviation. The districts are not as compact, and so that's one thing where they were not quite as compact, but not wildly out of line with previous maps, again, comparing to 2002. It split a few more counties, cities and towns and villages, but not a tremendous number more. And so their argument was that, hey, we still follow traditional districting principles, and so this really shouldn't be seen as an egregious constitutional violation. Barry mentioned that Simon Jackman, the other expert in the federal district court case, looked at every legislative districting from 1972 to 2014 and analyzed every single state legislative race in that time period. And then he ranked them in terms of this efficiency gap. Is every single districting from 72 to 2014 based on the efficiency gap with the most Republican ones? Wisconsin is down here. There are only three that had a larger efficiency gap on the Republican side in all of those redistrictings since 1972. So it's definitely out in the tail. And as Barry mentioned, also Jackman concluded that if you look at the back-to-back elections of 2012 and 2014, there isn't a single pair of elections in that entire time series that had a combined efficiency gap as big as the two in that pair of elections. And so this definitely is out on the tail. So one thing the plaintiffs are arguing was to say that, okay, maybe we can't draw the line exactly at 7%, which is what Jackman is arguing for, but we know that the Wisconsin plan was out further in the tail than that. And so even granting the point that, yes, there is some advantage that Republicans have, and because of the way that Democrats are concentrated, they're going to waste more votes because they are more concentrated in Milwaukee and Madison, even granting that point, you still have a much more seriously gerrymandered set of districts than you would have needed to have. So I'll conclude then with another thing that Barry mentioned were these simulations, that why not just let a computer do it and see what happens? Well, this is Joey Chen, is probably the nation's expert on this approach to redistricting, where he has a computer model that will just let a computer generate, you know, fair districts. And so what Joey Chen did, and this is an article that's forthcoming in Election Law Journal, so he does 200 simulations where he uses election data from Wisconsin and the geography of Wisconsin with all of the information about, you know, the population of the state to create equally sized districts. And he generates 200 simulations then of these districts. And then he does it for, you know, trying to get them compact as possible. And he looks at how many counties are split in this case. There's not one of those simulations that comes close to the actual map. Here's another one of looking at the efficiency gap. And this makes the point that the state was making that, yeah, we do have a natural advantage of being Republicans. We are going to have a bias in our favor because of the way the voters are distributed. But when the computer does it, you can see they're just eyeballing, what, maybe 160 of them to the left of the line and 40 to the right of the line, something like that, 170 to 30, something like that. And so there is that Republican tilt, no doubt, that there will be more bias in that direction. The end of that distribution, though, for generated by the computer is 6%. That's the most extreme bias, or maybe a little over 6.5. And then finally, this one looks at the number of Republican-leaning districts out of 99, and based on the number of municipalities that are split. Again, you can see the 200 simulations over there, Act 43 down by itself with, you know, 56 Republican-leaning districts. This is based on Romney vote exceeding Obama vote. You see, you know, 56 that are kind of leaning Republican, whereas the computer, the extreme ones on the computer generated ones are 47, 48, with a low end of only, you know, 30, 38 or 39. And so using that as a baseline to, you know, because the computer doesn't have any partisan bias. They're just cranking out the numbers. And so this is, you know, one way you can try to get a neutral baseline to compare it to see, you know, how does the map stack up. And so it does look like a pretty extreme outlier when you compare it on those grounds as well. So I did say I would talk about reform a little bit. Barry and Rob both talked about that to some extent as well, with nonpartisan commissions, bipartisan commissions being the choice. There are 14 states right now out of the 50 that have some form of commission playing a role in drawing district lines. My personal choice here is to have nonpartisan as opposed to bipartisan. I think the Iowa model is one that works better than most because you have the nonpartisan legislative bureau that draws up the maps, gives it to the state legislature for thumbs up, thumbs down vote. They can't amend it. And this seems to work better than some of the bipartisan ones. Like Arizona's had a real problem with theirs where they have had, it's supposed to be a bipartisan commission, but the people on the commission tend to be highly partisan themselves, and so they have a hard time getting things done, and that one hasn't worked quite as well. So I think the nonpartisan commission probably is the way to go. Yeah.
You've been listening to Partisan Gerrymandering and the U.S. Constitution. The speakers have been Rob Yablon, law professor at UW-Madison Law School, Barry Burden, professor of political science at UW-Madison, and David Cannon, professor of political science at UW-Madison. The talk took place on September 28, 2017, on the UW-Madison campus, and was sponsored by the Madison Institute, the League of Women Voters of Dane County and of Wisconsin, Common Cause Wisconsin, the American Constitution Society, and Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. To find out what else the Madison Institute is up to, go to their website at themadisoninstitute.org.